Checkerfin.
Fordham is always in my head.
Checkerfin. Checkerfin.
Yes.
It's the education gadfly
sex,
show.
Sex.
Mike and Rick tell you
early college, high school, pain and suffering,
in
your face, in your face,
your
face.
Listen to your word that they be preaching, cause here's the education gadfly show. Yeah. It's the education gadfly show.
Hello, this is your host Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Foundation, here with my co-host, the oh-so-delectable Dave DeShriver.
Hello, Michael. I'm glad to be delectable.
Did I pronounce that wrong again?
DeShriver?
Oh, no, delectable.
Delectable. You got that right. And my name right.
Hey, that's fantastic. That's two for two.
We're on a roll.
Hey, 100%. Welcome back to the show.
It's been some time. Yeah, thank you for having me.
Since you've been on the show, something big has happened. You have become a married man.
I am married now. Yeah, successfully since July 28th.
Wow. July 28th. So what is it? You're
that's
coming
a long
up on
time.
Your...
That could be my longest relationship.
That's very impressive. So like July, I was what, coming up on like your three-month anniversary?
That's big. Okay. Once we make it past six, it may last till 12.
Yeah, yeah.
Something to think about.
Now, last, I talked to you. You and your beautiful bride spent a lot of time sitting around your apartment watching your vacuum cleaner robot. Is that still how you end up spending a lot of your time together?
She doesn't watch as much as I do because I don't think she appreciates the genius of this device, the iRobot, how it gets out of tight corners.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's something to be said about allocating and distributing work towards the vacuum, towards the robot.
Yeah.
But how can you not stand there and watch it? Because it's clever. It's really clever.
Yeah.
And I just can't get enough of it. And there's a new robot out that does twice of what it does, and it's smarter.
Wow.
So I got to talk to my wife about that kind of a budget allocation.
Mm-hmm.
I think it'll work.
Yeah. I've been skeptical about the vacuum cleaning robot in the past.
Well, that's your mistake.
I think, yeah. It's my mistake.
Yeah. Oh, it really, it's, and it, you know, I am not getting paid to say this. I have nothing to do or have stock in iRobot. It's superb.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's entertainment for guys.
But I think this is the point here, Dave, is that if you want to maintain a happy marriage, you might need a little more talking and listening and a little less iRobot.
The floors are clean, Mike.
I'm just making
a suggestion. Really care what I say. The floors are clean.
Well, God bless her then.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. All right. Well, listeners, let us know if you've got an iRobot or want to weigh in on how Dave should strengthen his young marriage.
Or the requirements for successful marriage going forward.
Yes, that would be helpful too.
Yep. Clean floors being one of them.
You can send that to letters@excellence.net. By the way, I am still here. Last week, I said something about how I might not be here. Something about having a baby.
Yeah, more importantly, let's talk about you. What's your status?
Yeah, well, my status is the same as is my unborn son's, who is still hanging out
inside
the womb. I don't think of it as trapped. I think he's just not quite ready. We are 4 days overdue. We're into overtime. You know, but I this is good. Look, we tried to get pregnant for a long time, so this is sort of, we're just making the most out of it.
Right. Maybe next week you will not be here.
I think that's probably likely.
I hope that for likely.
So we got to blow it
reasons.
Out. This might be the last podcast I do for a couple weeks at least, so let's enjoy it.
All right, then.
We've got the game of Pardon the Gadfly. Then we'll have an interview with Neil McCluskey of the Cato Institution. And finally, Liam will impart some education news of the weird. Sound good?
Perfect.
Okay, Christina, let's get started.
The New York Times writes about California. There are 1,000 schools in California eligible for restructuring. Nobody thinks the state or district or anyone else has the capacity to help or shut down all of these schools at once. Will a growth model save the day? If not, what's the solution?
Well, Mike, there are two issues here. First of all, the identification system. You know, will a growth model save the day? It's better. I don't think it's going to save the day, though. And the second issue, do the LEAs and SEAs have the capacity to make these changes? And I'm looking at a book in front of me entitled No Remedy Left Behind, which makes the point that maybe they're not the right vehicle for change. And I think there's really something to be said for that. So the identification is a little bit clumsy. Growth model, sure, it's going to be better. But a lot of it, if you keep on tying it to a 2014 date, you're setting it up for failure. So we have problems with the identification system. We have problems with the capacity to make change.
Right. Okay.
It's an issue.
Now in the article, it does say that the state is basically arguing that 700 out of these 1,000 schools would not be considered failing under the state's own system, which I assume means that they are looking at growth over time and they think these schools are getting better, at least marginally,
right?
It wouldn't be on the list. So then you're talking about 300 schools in a big state like California. That's a little more manageable. You talk about capacity. I want to talk about political will. I mean, the fundamental issue is closing down a school and reopening it is hard work. It takes having somebody who wants that strategy and make it work. It means ruffling feathers, maybe firing teachers. I mean, this is a political quagmire. I think what we need are some more strong leaders who want to take this approach. And we need to stop thinking about turning around these schools. We got to talk about shutting them down and replacing them with schools like KIPP, Green Dot, Aspire, on and on.
Yeah, I agree. But you also got to give the SEA some incentive to do this. Right now, they just have a laundry list of options. None of them are very sexy. None of them are appealing. So where is their creativity in their jurisdiction? And I think if you target that, incentivize that, then you can really begin to move this forward. But until then, not a chance.
Dave, what's one of your clients? Is it the...
It would be the California Department of Education.
Ah, yes. I just wanted... Yes.
Yeah, and you know what? They're right on this issue. And I don't say that just because they're a client, but because there needs to be greater state discretion in this issue. That's across the states.
Dave, you know, I've known you for a long time, but you are finally... You've made it here in Washington. You are now a fast-talking Washington lawyer.
Well, I'm talking to a fast-talking pundit. Are you kidding me?
I'm just saying. I'm just calling it like it is.
I'm spinning my wheels trying to keep up here,
I'm
Mike.
I'm just calling it like it is. I'm just teasing you. All right, Christina, next topic.
All right, topic two. The Columbus Dispatch has reported that Ohio's Department of Education is doing a terrible job making teacher discipline actions transparent. As a result, districts are hiring people who have been disciplined for inappropriate behavior with children. Should all of this information be online? What about just complaints against teachers or teachers with repeated complaints against them?
Dave, I think this series is incredibly troubling. They dug up plenty of instances of teachers that did all kinds of crazy and horrible things with children, were disciplined for it, but those records seem to disappear into the ether, and those teachers ended up getting hired by a different school district as a result. You know, other states have figured out how to manage this by at least creating a statewide database of teacher disciplinary actions and putting it online. I don't see why every state in the country shouldn't do that.
I think it's a bit of a witch hunt. First of all, you know, Ohio Department of Education has a due process in place. So it's a question of due process. And if you're going to put this stuff on the web and you haven't had the proper procedures to actually verify this stuff, what you're talking about is defamation. Now, I really don't think that's the state of the department, what the Department of Education wants to do. Maybe if they put up the stats of those who have been disciplined, say you have an X amount of teachers in this jurisdiction who have been disciplined, sure. But you know, if you don't do it right, you're tripping on defamation. It's a bad, really bad move. And okay. I think the Dispatch is pushing the issue unnecessarily.
But defamation, I mean, certainly I understand that it's not fair to put online just if a teacher has been charged with some sort of disciplinary, misconduct, because that is, you know, guilty before being proven innocent. But if there has been a disciplinary action taken, then that seems like that should be public information. At the very least, school districts should have that information so that they don't mistakenly hire somebody who's got a track record that shows they shouldn't be with kids.
Maybe you have to require them to be on Facebook and then have peer reviews of those who accuse them. You could hash it out in a social environment.
Huh.
Social networking, justice.
Interesting. You know, oftentimes people think that Facebook is part of the problem when we're talking about, you know, sexual molestation of children. And now you're saying that it might be part of the solution.
Oh, no, it has better safeguards. For example, if I have a girlfriend, say, who I made out with a period of time, I'm married, so maybe this is a bad reference, right? But let's say if I did that, if I claim to have done that,
right,
she has to verify it.
I see.
Right? So if
there's the analogy?
So the analogy here, so if the Ohio Department of Education makes them put up a Facebook page and there's an accusation, there has to be some type of verification process. Hmm. And so it's basically you're confronting your accuser through social networking.
Mm-hmm.
And with that, I think that's our ideal solution.
I'm so confused. This is such you have become a great lawyer. I'm just baffled by. I mean, I think it's great logic. I'm just confused. This is how you win arguments.
This is the beauty of Web 2.0. In a social justice education environment.
It's all over my head. All right, Christina.
Last one. Chicago, which already has the largest junior military reserve program in the nation, is opening the nation's first public high school run by the Marines. Peace activists and some civil rights groups don't like it for obvious reasons. But the city's current crop of military schools are, quite frankly, not producing very good academic results. Are these schools just trying to recruit poor kids into the war in Iraq?
Now, Mike, I did some me and my staff did some crack research on this issue, and here's what we found. There are three active military installations in the Illinois area, mm-hmm. of which one is a naval station near Chicago. Thus, unless these things have aquatic, swimming, or navigation arts, I don't think it's a feeder system.
Huh. Well, There you have it. Interesting. Yet you are assuming that they're just recruiting these kids to serve on those bases in the vicinity. We're talking about sending the kids to Iraq.
That's true. You could ship them.
Look, when we first saw this article, we thought, oh man, this is just more liberal PC propaganda, the kind of stuff coming out of my hometown at Tacoma Park all the time. You know, they're just complaining about these ROTC programs, which, you know, for the most part seem to be good for kids. But in fact, when you look at the test scores of these schools, at least in Chicago, they're abysmal. I mean, really abysmal. And so you say, wow, I mean, why is it that some schools that are run with a lot of discipline, like KIPP, can get great results? And yet here you are having military schools, and they're getting terrible academic results. I don't know. I think it just feeds into this perception that all these schools are trying to do is to recruit poor kids to send them overseas to die for their country.
Well, it's somewhat of a noble cause. It's a volunteer army.
Yeah.
They certainly need soldiers.
Be nice if they provide an education for these kids too, though, don't you think?
Well, I really think maybe just check out, see if they do navigation arts, because if it is, we're on to something.
Okay. All right. I like that. All right. Well, that is it for Pardon the Gadfly. We are on to our interview with Neil McCluskey. Let's take a listen. Joining us today on the Education Gadfly Show is Neil McCluskey, a scholar at the Cato Institute and author of the book Feds in the Classroom. Neil, welcome to the Education Gadfly Show.
All right. Thanks for having me on.
So, Neil, you had some reaction to an editorial that our own Liam Julian wrote in the Gadfly last week. He criticized your book, arguing that it was not very realistic. It was kind of a typical sharp libertarian argument for dismantling government, but didn't offer constructive proposals. And you found that that criticism was a little unfair. So let's hear from your side of the story.
Well, I mean, there's a lot in the book that was just totally neglected. And really, the most important point of the book is this. And this is what fills the history chapters. This is what fills the test score analyses, is that the biggest problem that we have in education now stems from government involvement in education. So, you know, Liam talked about, I said that school choice was the key to fixing the problem, which is true. But that is not nearly as central as this point that is made throughout the book, which is if you look at local involvement and then more state involvement and then federal involvement, each level has basically rendered the same thing, which is stagnation. And the reason is that when government's in charge, invariably the system works for the people employed by the school system or for the politicians, not for the parents. And so all that failure is why I say you've got to have school choice so that accountability can come directly from the people who want the good education, not the other politicians.
All right. Well, this is a typical argument that we at Fordham tend to have with some of you libertarians. You know, we of course support school choice. We just don't think that school choice is enough. So, you know, set aside whether or not it's realistic to pull government out of education entirely. I mean, don't you think the taxpayers have some right to know that their dollars are being spent on schools that are meeting some sort of reasonable standard?
Well, you know, I would say that the best arbiters of whether or not a school is producing what they need educationally is parents. They should be the basic building block of deciding what a good school is. Now, nowhere in the book, though, do I say we should just have zero government oversight whatsoever. I think we do need to make sure there's universal school choice. Every parent fundamentally has the ability to choose their child's school. There would certainly be room for laws that continue to say, just as we have laws against child abuse, that if there is reasonable doubt that somebody is educating their child to a certain minimum level, then the state can step in and force it. But the default should always be that the parents are proven or innocent until proven guilty, and they ultimately are the ones who decide where and how their child is educated, unless it can be proven that they are not educating their child.
Okay, but Neil, it's easy to prove that there's lots of kids in schools that are not educating them very well. We see that in the public sector, in the charter sector, and in the private school sector. And for a variety of reasons, we know that parents, when faced with lots of bad options, will end up putting their kids in schools, choosing schools that are not succeeding academically. So, you know, I don't know, or maybe we're agreeing if you know, that there has to be some minimal standard. And shouldn't that standard have to do with academic achievement?
Well, except, you know, what we're talking about is we say their parents are making, you know, less than ideal choices, but the system they're in is far from ideal. So the really good choices and the mechanisms to make sure that people all have good choices just aren't there. I mean, 90% of schools are public schools, which means they're driven by a public monopoly. This is totally different from if you look at something like consumer electronics or automotive, or look at how we have packages delivered by FedEx. You have got to have competition, and you have to have real ability for consumers to leave somewhere that's bad and take their money with them and bring it to someone who's a good service provider. Then everybody will get a better product. You don't have to be an expert in that subject area to be able to get one, because you have a nucleus of good choosers who make sure that the providers are held to a high standard. And so everybody can get something good. But right now what we're saying is, well, people might choose a charter school or a private school if they have a voucher that might not have the best academics, but of course their other option is a regular public school with equally poor academics where it's also violent, there's no order, and the child could get shot. So I don't think we have a system yet where we could ever say that the options are even out there in abundance.
Well, I think in at least a few cities like Dayton, where, of course, we do a lot of work, we're now getting to the point where there's a lot of choices, and we've got to strain a bit to say that all those choices and competition are necessarily making all the schools get better. But let's go back, though, finally to your government point, though. It seems to be a strong skepticism that government or government policy can really do any good. How do you deal, though, when you look at some states like Florida or like Massachusetts that in the last decade or so have made huge, huge improvements in the student achievement of their most disadvantaged kids? In some cases, now kids reading, a year, more than a year grade level better than their peers did, say, a decade ago in those states. Doesn't that prove that smart government policy can really make a difference?
Well, I mean, what you're talking about is a very tiny number of states, really, where you see any kind of market improvement. Actually, in only Massachusetts, I would hold up and say, this place is different from the rest.
Oh, Florida has made, incredible gains, Neil. I mean, something like a grade level and a half for African-American students over the past decade or so. I mean, incredible, historic gains.
Suppose we hold out Massachusetts, California, Florida, and, throw in one other state. Even if you're talking about 4 out of 50, what kind of batting average is that? Nobody who hits .080 is ever going to stay playing professional baseball. And I certainly think it is better that we have state control than the direction we're heading in now, which is, of course, the title of the book, Feds in the Classroom. The worst thing we can do is have federal control. At least let states like Florida, like Massachusetts, continue to experiment with new and innovative governance structures. So at least then you have competition and you have these laboratories. The worst thing we could do is centralize more. But even better then is to root education school choice like they're doing in Florida, like they're doing in Massachusetts, but making it more widespread. And that's why choice is the key. And centralizing more and more is clearly the route to failure.
All right. Neil McCluskey, choice is the key. Thank you, Neil, for coming on the show. We appreciate your comments and hope you'll come back sometime.
Oh, I'd love to. Thanks a lot for having me on.
So, Dave, what do you think? Last week, Liam really went after Neil in the gadfly, and Neil now tries to say that Liam's criticisms were misguided. But I think I heard him basically say that we were right, that school choice is not enough. You've got to have some sort of minimal standards around academic achievement, too.
I don't know what you did to Neil prior to the interview. I can't imagine Neil backing off of the issue. If there's one thing he is consistent. So, I'd like to see what you discussed beforehand, and then because of the digital editing matters, I can't believe actually Neil bowed to your opinions.
Ah, very skeptical. Liam, what do you think? Anything about Neil's argument convince you?
No, not particularly.
Okay, that's it. Yeah, Liam, every once in a while we try to push Liam to go news of the weird routine, and he just doesn't seem willing to do it.
What part didn't convince you that it's only vouchers, or it's something more than vouchers?
Well, I mean, the piece I wrote last week criticized this sort of strict libertarian perspective. And I think basically Neil said in the interview that you can have a strict libertarian perspective, that there has to be some sort of oversight.
Right. So he conceded your point.
I don't know if that's a concession. It seemed...
Take it. You broke him.
Yeah. But to be fair, you know, Neil did say in a letter to the editor in the Gadfly that Liam took some of his arguments out of context. Neil talked about how great education was in the colonial period, and Liam pointed out that that wasn't so great for women and African Americans. But Neil says, look, if you read his book as a whole, he talks about. So we're going to move on to everyone's favorite feature, what we wait for all week long, because it is that time, education news of the weird time, with our special correspondent,
beautiful
Liam Julian. Liam, what's weird this week?
14-year-old Claudius Benson, who was expelled from Detroit's Redford Academy because he has long hair, can go back to school. The school board voted to reinstate him. Benson has long hair because of his religion. His mother said, quote, "I consider myself a contemporary African-American Hebrew if you're looking for a label," unquote. Mrs. Benson strictly abides by various Old Testament provisions, including a passage in the book of Leviticus that forbids the cutting of hair. Quote, "Ye shall not round the corners of your heads, neither shalt thou mar the corners of your beard," unquote, Leviticus 19:27. Which means Claudius has not cut his hair since he was 4 years old, and that's education news of the weird.
Wait, shall not round the corners? Is that what it said? Is it flat top okay?
Do you have like one of those?
Yeah. If you want maybe just a strict legal analysis here, it says round.
Nice, we do have one.
Yeah, good. Right. Good, Kobe. I think this is an interesting case. I mean, kicking the guy out because of long hair?
Yeah, well, this is another issue where standards matter. I mean, you know, if they had standards in place, something you could measure towards,
yeah,
this wouldn't be an issue.
Right. All right. Well, Liam, thank you. That was weird indeed. I'm glad that this young man has a chance to go back to school again with his long hair. And I'd like to see a picture of that. Maybe we can put that on our website. Yeah, I like that. Maybe long hair on Checker. That would be kind of fun. Yeah, that would be
good idea.
All right. Well, listeners, you can look for that on our website, www.edexcellence.net. Till after my paternity leave, that's the wrap. Dave?
This is Dave DeShriver wishing Michael a happy fatherhood.
And this is Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Foundation signing off.